In the spoken meditation, we reflected briefly on the question of, did the Greeks believe their own myths? You can fruitfully explore similar questions in regard to the ancient stories and myths of the Bible. And when I've taught Intro to the Hebrew Bible, which I'll be doing this spring at Frederick Community College and probably sometime here, though I'm couching it under the catchier title, Banned Questions About the Bible, one of my favorite resources to use is an extraordinarily helpful book called Old Testament Parallels, which highlights the many similar ancient Near Eastern stories that preceded or were contemporary to the stories found in the Hebrew Bible, such as famously the parallels to the Adam and Eve story and to the Noah's flood story that are in the Epic of Gilgamesh that Laura alluded to briefly. And as a brief footnote, if any of you have been to the movies recently, have you seen Daniel Aronofsky is directing a film on Noah's flood? He's the one who did Black Swan recently, like a very talent. This is going to be interesting. Future sermon, perhaps forthcoming. But those stories like the Epic of Gilgamesh were likely direct sources of the biblical accounts. And the effect of learning about these antecedents, and there are many more to the biblical stories, was captured satirically by The Onion a few years ago in an article titled, "Sumerians Look On in Confusion as God Creates the World." I'll share only the first two paragraphs. Lord God, creator of all, caught thousands of Sumerian farmers and mathematicians somewhat off guard. Members of the Earth's earliest known civilization, the Sumerians, looked on in shock and confusion about 6,000 years ago as God, the Lord Almighty, created heaven and earth. "I don't understand," reads a line of ancient pictographs, depicting the sun, the moon, the water, and a Sumerian scratching his head. A booming voice is saying, "Let there is light." But there's already light. It's saying, "Let the earth bring forth grass," but I'm already standing on grass. Now, let me clarify that my intention in sharing that story is not to mock people's beliefs then or now, but it is to create cognitive dissonance. I should also hasten to add here at the outset that although there is much more to say about all of this, this is about 5 minutes of the 23-hour class that I've taught in the Hebrew Bible, the conclusion I've reached for myself in regard to myths then and now is that we tell contemporary myths, which I'll get to shortly, for similar reasons to why our ancestors told myths in their day, both to entertain and also to make sense and meaning out of our life, out of our experiences, and out of our place in this world. In addition, I would say that one of the most common mistakes we sometimes make is to view ancient peoples as stupid for telling or believing what appear to us to be stupid stories about the world. Instead, I would invite you to consider that both ancient and modern people are less stupid than they are tribalistic and polemical. I'll explain. A polemic is an argument that tries to show why one side is right and the other side is wrong. Both then and now, we human beings have a tendency to cling to people who are like us and to tell stories that legitimate our worldview. If you've ever wondered, for example, in Genesis 1, why doesn't it just say that the Lord God, that Yahweh created the sun and the moon? Instead, it says, if you'll remember from Genesis 1, God created a greater light to rule the day and a lesser night to rule. Well, if they'd used that word for sun, Shamash, that's the same word as the Akkadian sun god. So they would have been saying that Yahweh created a lesser god. And if you're interested in establishing monotheism, you use a circumlocution. If you're writing in the ancient Near East, you say the greater light to rule the day and the lesser night to rule. But I digress and can continue going on. But to see that this tendency to be tribalistic and polemical, and to tell stories that legitimate our worldview, to see that that continues today, just like it did in the ancient Near East, you need do nothing more than set your remote control to flip back and forth between Fox News and MSNBC. To see that overarching mythic, tribalistic, and polemical worldviews and approaches continue to dominate our world. And that's precisely what the ancient Hebrew people, the ancient Christian people, the ancient Egyptian people, the ancient Sumerian people, and all those other people groups throughout time were often doing with their myths. They were telling stories that sought to create meaning, often in ways that were exclusionary of competing worldviews. Biblical scholar John Dominic Crossan puts it this way, though, about why those myths nevertheless can still be valuable. He says, "We began to think in the Enlightenment that ancient people told dumb, literal stories that we were now smart enough to recognize as such." Not quite. Those ancient people told smart, metaphorical stories that we're now dumb enough to take literally. Enlightenment, yes, but endarkenment also. The opportunity, then, is perhaps to reclaim these stories, not on a literal level, but on an archetypal level, for the deep truths that they can reveal to us about the human condition. Now, keeping all that we've just said about ancient myths in mind, I'd like to shift our attention to some contemporary myths, and just as I've come to believe that it's mistaken to dismiss ancient myths as dumb literal stories, I also think it is mistaken to see many contemporary fictions as just dumb entertainment. Lying just below the surface of many of our contemporary myths are profound truths about the human condition. For this morning, I'd like to concentrate on just two specific examples: the Hunger Games trilogy and the explosion of zombie stories, no pun intended, in recent years. The first Hunger Games book was published in 2008, and since then, both the books and the films have gone on to earn millions upon millions upon millions of dollars, and they've barely gotten started. You know, they're splitting the third movie into two, which is only slightly less audacious than splitting The Hobbit into three movies. But, you know, Hollywood has to make money just like the rest of us, I guess. How many of you have read the Hunger Games books? Read the books? All right, that's a pretty good bit. How many of you have seen the first two films? All right, so less. Okay, fair amount of readers out there. All right. The trilogy centers around the story of Katniss Everdeen, a teenage girl in a post-apocalyptic version of our own society. That's very important. It's a version of our own North America. From the ruins of war and environmental catastrophe, a super wealthy elite now lives in a single capital city and rules with an iron fist over the impoverished masses, who have been divided into 12 districts for easier crowd control. Each year, the capital demands that one boy and one girl from each district be chosen by lot as a tribute to the capital and as a reminder that any rebellion by the masses against the capital will be met with the direst of consequences. It's similar to what people used to call the Peace of Rome. Well, the only reason you had the Peace of Rome is that if you had an insurrection, the Roman legions on those Roman roads, which they built so the legions could move around very easily, would come and enforce the peace. And very similarly, you have in the Hunger Games series, the cops, which are based in very militaristic gear, not unlike what you've seen in some of our own police recently, that they're called the peacekeepers. The cops are called the peacekeepers, just like the Peace of Rome. But those two tributes from each district that are selected each year are then forced to fight to the death in a highly celebrated and televised event known as the Hunger Games, from which only one winner is allowed to emerge from the 24 children who enter. And I first started paying more attention to the Hunger Games phenomenon when the first film was released in March 2012. Now, keep in mind, if you can kind of go back to March 2012 in your head, that when myself and millions of others first saw that film in the theaters, the Occupy Wall Street protests had started only months earlier in September 2011, protesting the wealth gap in our society and rallying behind the phrase, "We are the 99%. And although the whole idea of our children being taken from us as tributes to a wealthy elite seems rightly horrific, keep in mind that District 12, where Katniss, our protagonist in the series, is from, is set in the coal mining region of Appalachia, not far from here. And the differences today, in 2013, in opportunities for a child growing up in Manhattan among the wealthy elite, the wealthy 1%, or the 0.1%, and a child growing up in Appalachia or the Louisiana Delta, the differences in opportunities and life experiences for that child today in our own time, while not as epically heinous as the Hunger Games, do call us to question the inequalities that we consent to and allow to exist in our society. And while the Hunger Games can be viewed as simply young adult entertainment, upon closer inspection, the author, Suzanne Collins, is well aware of the parallels that she is drawing to our current society and to ancient history, such as Rome, and the ways in which we may be similar to the Roman Empire, more than we may be comfortable with. Though if you just visit Washington, D.C., is it any question that we're imitating Rome? But one of the clearest examples that she has given her post-apocalyptic vision of North America is the same as Rome is the name she gives for it. She calls it Panem, P-A-N-E-M. And to acknowledge the explicit allusion in the name Panem, Collins says, inserts the following exchange explicitly in the third volume of her series, which is set during a rebellion by the impoverished districts against the wealthy elite. She writes, "Panem et Circenses is a saying from about 1,000 years ago written in a language called Latin about a place called Rome. It translates into bread and circuses. The writer was saying that in return for full bellies and entertainment, his people had given up their political responsibilities and therefore their power. So that's what the districts are for, to provide bread and circuses for the wealthy elite. And as long as that keeps rolling in, the capital could control its little empire. Right now, it can provide neither. And rebellion ensues." And it makes me think, what would have happened with the Occupy Wall Street if cable had been canceled at the same time, if you'd been unable to watch TV or go to the movies? I think more people would have been out. You know, so what are the ways in which our entertainment placates us and keeps us from being involved with grassroots movement? Collins has said in interviews that the trilogy was inspired as she flipped channels between mindless reality TV shows and the coverage of the start of the Iraq War. And that dissonance between those two things inspired her to write The Hunger Games. And accordingly, over the course of The Hunger Games trilogy, Collins provides some fascinating explorations of the power and the pitfalls of protesting against the powers that be. Now, in going further, I want to beware of spoilers in case some of you, want to go out and see the movies fresh. But allow me to give just a few examples. Given the ubiquity, almost inescapable ubiquity of trailers for the second film that feature Katniss, I don't think I'm giving too much away by saying that Katniss and Peeta, though entrants in the first Hunger Games, nevertheless survive. Two survive instead of just one. Even though the capital demands that there be only one. And what's fascinating, as well as deeply resonant with the theatrical tactics of the Occupy Wall Street movement, is the way that Katniss employs drama and visual theater to shame the powers that be in the Capitol in front of national television. It wouldn't have worked otherwise. If it had happened in private, they would have just killed them both. But that she does it on national television in a way that lets them both live, lest they become martyrs and inspire a mass uprising. The second installment of the book in the film that's now in theaters picks up precisely on the other side of that moment, which is the exact opposite of happily ever after for Katniss and Peeta, who have survived. As theologian Julie Clausen has written, unless Katniss can convince the districts that her act was done purely out of love for Peeta and not as resistance to the Capitol, everyone she loves will get hurt, if not killed. And as Katniss becomes more bold in her activism against inequality and injustice in the third book and begins to join the resistance against the Capitol more directly, the fascinating and, I would add, deeply true and realistic twist is that the resistance to the fascist leadership in the Capitol begins ironically to look more and more like everything she hated about the Capitol in the first place. As Audre Lorde, the self-described black lesbian mother warrior poet, titled her famous essay, "The Master's Tools Will Never Dismantle the Master's House, Only Rebuild the Master's House. The Master's Tools Will Only Set Up a New Master or a New Pharaoh to invoke the old myths, and of course, a new oppressed slave class in its place." And at this point, I really want to tell you the truly shocking act of subversion that Katniss does in the final book to try and prevent a new master from being set up in place of the old president of the Capitol, as well as the tragedy that gives her the courage to do so, but I'll restrain myself. Ultimately, my point is that The Hunger Games is a fascinating contemporary myth about the power and hazards of a resistance movement against a very powerful powers that be, such as Occupy Wall Street, you know, trying to fight against wealth inequality and injustice. And there are many fascinating aspects, such as how an act of kindness, putting flowers on the body of a young black girl who is killed in the Hunger Games, how that transforms that young girl's unjust death into not just a tragedy, but again into a martyrdom that is an inspiration for the resistance. And as the president of the Capitol says in the first film, hope is the only thing stronger than fear. A little hope is effective. A lot of hope is dangerous. A spark is fine as long as it's contained. Or as I heard Wendell Berry, one of our contemporary prophets, say in an interview last weekend at the American Academy of Religion, hope is a virtue. I think we forget that sometimes. Hope is a virtue. It's a practice. There's a lot of wisdom in those four words. Hope is a virtue. And hope reminds us that the way the world is not the way the world has to be. We can create change. And although the struggle for social justice is far from done, the steps that have been made even in the past 100 years alone for race, gender, and sexual equality. I mean, keep in mind, women haven't even had the right to vote in the United States for a full 100 years. You were really quick to judge Saudi Arabia, and I'm fine with judging the inequality of women there. But keep in mind how much work we have done just in the past 100 years in our society and how much we have to do. But the work that has been done even in the past 100 years gives me hope that change is possible too in regard to class inequality and to that difference that we currently allow to exist between what goes on in Manhattan and in many of our cities versus what goes on in Appalachia and the Louisiana Delta and other impoverished places. And I'm very interested in the ways that contemporary myths, such as the Hunger Games, are planting seeds in the minds of a current and future generation that could come into fruition for future justice work. But there's no assurance that the Hunger Games will inspire concrete acts of social justice. It could stay at the level of just entertainment. You need look no further than the CoverGirl and Subway ads to see the ways in which the Hunger Games mythos is already and immediately has been commodified for corporate profit. When Laura Powell Haney, our DRE, mentioned the CoverGirl marketing campaign, I really need to see this for myself. So I Googled it. Some of you may have seen this. The CoverGirl Capital Collection. It seeks to convince young women, of course young men are not mentioned in the ads, to buy their products to dress up like the wealthy elite in the Capitol. CoverGirl, I assume, so there's a different makeup line for each of the 12 districts so you're representing, so you can dress up like the ones who choose. So CoverGirl, I assume, is hoping you won't notice that they're inviting your children to pretend that they are the clueless consumerist crowds that are placated by the fascist spectacle of poor children being forced to kill other poor children for entertainment and societal oppression in a futuristic reenactment of ancient Rome's bread and circuses. I mean, it's horrifying when you take a step back, but they're seemingly getting away with it. In another exercise in intentionally missing the point to make profit, Subway is promoting four new sandwiches in their Fiery Footlong collection, which it claims was inspired by the second Hunger Games film, Catching Fire. You know, it has the Hunger Games logo and all of that. Now, I like spicy food, and these sandwiches may well be delicious, but I can't help but find them in bad taste. This film is about the plight of starving, oppressed peasants, and your restaurant franchise is free associating from the film's title, Catching Fire, and the series' title, Hunger Games, to promote a spicy set of sandwiches. But the fact that Subway is likely selling sandwiches as a result of this ad campaign allows me to make a tragic segue to our society's current fascination on both film and television with the zombie apocalypse. The segue from Subway is, of course, that clearly one mythic aspect of the zombie archetype is a representation of the mindless, consuming hordes, who consume only one thing after another without thinking about it, and finally, the whole consumerist society is itself consumed. But more importantly, I don't think it's a coincidence that both The Hunger Games and all these zombie films and TV shows that are hugely popular right now are both post-apocalyptic dystopias. How much different are these visions of society than the technological utopias that came out of the 60s, such as Star Trek? Barely, you know, which actually got some things right, you know, like the iPad you can see predicted by Star Trek, or things like the holodeck. This is getting a little nerdy, I know, but think about the holodeck and the ways in which, you know, we sit in front of TV and are, and you know, versus they would say, why would I want to sit in front of TV? I want to participate in the story. And so that move to participating and being involved, how, and the ways in which that, anyway, predicted by, anyway. And so I guess what I'm saying is the ways in which science fiction, you know, it comes true in, you know, in slightly askew ways. But barely underneath the surface of our technology-infused society is the repressed knowledge, or we try to repress it, that in many cases our smartphones, our iPads, our laptops, those are the product of sweatshops, and the anxiety that we're losing our land-based survivalist knowledge that our ancestors had of how to grow our own food, so what would happen if, you know, we lost power and had to grow our own food again? Zombies also represent our fear of the other, the barbarians at the gate, to use an ancient Rome analogy, those outside of our tribe, and the current popularity of post-apocalyptic dystopias are also about our need to explore what might happen on the other side of either a nuclear disaster or a climate-caused disaster that very well could happen in our future. And we may never get to that imagined future techno-utopia of Star Trek's 23rd century if our species doesn't make it to the 23rd century, which may cause our current fascination not with utopia, but with dystopic myths. And learning to better explore and articulate the underlying meaning of these contemporary myths could be vitally important in harnessing their meaning in the work of social justice. In that spirit, I'll end with one more quote from Wendell Berry. In that same interview that I saw with him last week, which was great, if it's recorded, I'll get you a copy of it or email it to you, because the interviewer kept slipping him poems to read every 10 minutes or so, which was nice. So in that same interview that I saw last weekend, the interviewer asked him to read his poem, The Peace of Wild Things. It goes like this. When despair for the world grows within me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's life may be, I go and I lie down where the wooddrake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds, and I come into the peace of wild things, who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars, waiting for their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. After reading those beautiful words, Berry surprised both the interviewer and the audience by confessing that he regrets writing part of that poem, the part in which he refers to the animals as the wild things. He says that the more he's thought about that poem and the more he's watched animals since then, he's come to see that they're not wild, per se. They're conducting domestic life and see us as wild, as invading their habitat. He said, animals see us as wild, as out of control, as lacking in compassion, and they are right. So I invite you to consider, what stories are we telling about ourselves? Are we telling ourselves? What stories are we telling our children? And how are those stories shaping our society and the future society into which our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren will live in? If we're going to live into more of a utopia than a dystopia, any changes that would make enough of a difference must be systemic, not just individual. We get that wrong a lot, too. It's not just about whether you recycle. It's about how we structure our whole society and our whole world. Those systemic institutional changes make epically more difference than the car you drive and whether you recycle, though that's important, too. The lesson of the sermon is not don't recycle. So But that being said, are our contemporary myths merely fodder to sell more makeup and fast food sandwiches, or are we, while there is still time, willing to claim and act on the deeper meaning of the contemporary myths that resonate with us most deeply, and they resonate with us most deeply because they really matter? The needed change will require work more like that hard grassroots organizing of Occupy Wall Street, and they will certainly require more than simply buying a ticket to or reading a copy of books like The Hunger Games, although that's a first step. The stories we choose to tell are important, but so too is the decision whether or not to structure our society more justly and equitably. And the choice, at least for now, is ours.